Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to all of you to today's Born Human podcast. Today, it's my privilege to introduce to you Mr. Maurice Doyle. Maurice is someone that I've recently become connected with through the work that I'm doing with Born Human. And I guess we have a very common outlook on the world. Maurice recently became a coach and a leadership coach specifically, and runs the business Generous Spirits, which is he's doing some amazing work with. But he spent almost 30 years in the drinks industry, pioneering some incredible change there and some incredible business success. And what I really love about Maurice is the fact that in my experience of corporate life, you don't often come across people that are as human-centric as he is. And what I was interested to talk to Maurice about was how he balanced a really successful career in his industry with a family life that was really important to him. I think it's a really relatable conversation for many of us these days, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. I'll leave you to the two of us having a chat. Hello and welcome to today's Born Human podcast. Today I am joined, I have the privilege to introduce Maurice Doyle. Maurice is someone that I've come to know more recently on my journey with Born Human, I suppose, in terms of starting it and having a change of direction. And I guess thinking about the humanity of it all and the people side of what life is all about, really. Maurice has had a similar journey. Maurice is the founder of Generous Spirits, which he'll tell us a bit more about later on. But Maurice is someone that has spent a long time in sort of heading up large organisations in the drinks industry. To his peril, I'm going to introduce the fact that he was responsible for introducing the Bacardi Breezer into the UK and changing my outlook with potential suitors to regrets and all those kind of things.
I gave you, Andy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we didn't even know each other then. So exactly. Think of the amount of people you've influenced with that. But yes, so I had a very successful career in the drinks industry. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and understanding kind of what that was like as a father. But I guess initially I'd like to say welcome, Maurice. Thank you for coming on and joining us.
Thanks, Andy. It's a pleasure being here.
Yeah, pleasure to have you. So let's kick off by kind of getting a bit of background to your family. How many children have you got and how old are they, et cetera, et cetera?
Perfect. Well, I'm married to Sally and together we have three boys.
Wonderful. And it's fair to say, we've obviously talked before this anyway, so it would come as no surprise that that would happen. But it wasn't necessarily a straightforward journey for you to become parents.
No, it. First of all, it took me some time to find the perfect partner, somebody I wanted to spend the rest of my life with and to share the parenting journey with. And I was lucky to eventually find Sally. So that took a little bit of time. And then when it came to having made the decision, yes, we wanted to be parents, that also took some time. So like many people, we went down the IVF route and there was challenges and heartbreaks and joys along the way. But eventually we were blessed in terms of to be able to have twins, first of all. And I remember, Andy, probably one of the stupidest things I've ever said was when we were going for a scan, one of the first scans, they showed me kind of two heartbeats. And my first thought, which I said out loud, was, oh, my God, our baby's got two hearts. At which point Sally and the nurse just looked at me kind of with pity, probably, and then realized, no, actually, it's two separate babies. We're going to have twins. And I'd never considered the possibility of having twins before. And so then for about 5 minutes, I was just completely silent, contemplating what was ahead of us.
Yeah.
But it's been amazing. It's been ups and downs, obviously, like with every parenting journey, but it's been a blessing.
Yeah, because with IVF, there's a higher chance of twins and multiple pregnancies, right? I guess to some extent, were you prepared for that or did you kind of have that in the back of your mind?
Academically, I knew there was a possibility, but I always thought it was something that would happen to other people. as opposed to something that was going to happen to us.
And
probably had we had the single baby first, I would have been even more scared, because I would have understood more about what was ahead of us.
Yeah.
Because we started with the twins first, it became like that was the norm.
Yeah.
And therefore, having the third single child turned out to be easier than our expectations. So it was probably, for us, the best way of sequencing it. But we're happy with how it worked. And it's great. We have three amazing boys in terms of who are approaching young men now.
Yeah. Are they identical twins, non-identical?
No, they're not. There is a common Doyle look, so you definitely recognise if you were to see them, Andy, that they're all from the same, cut from the same cloth.
Yeah.
But they're different in sizes, different in personalities, different in look. So, yeah, definitely non-identical.
Technical twins only then, kind of.
Yeah.
Definitely not the same people.
No.
Yeah. Very different. It's an interesting, that kind of thing. And I think it's the twins that I know over the years and that you've come to know, it's kind of asserting your own identity as a twin is often quite a challenging thing, right? How do they find that? Do they find it, have they found their own ways kind of thing?
Yeah, they have found their own ways. We were very conscious of that. We were conscious that they didn't have to automatically come as a pair. And so we try to find schools that had kind of classes that were, they could be in different classes, and so they can have different friends. And although they have many of the same interests, they do have different friend groups. And I think being in different classes and now doing different subjects means that they have separate lives. So
yeah,
they're not comparing one to the other. So one isn't another version of Jack, or another version of Barney, the Jack in their own right, or Barney.
Yeah. Yeah, which is great, right? And it's a conscious thing that it sounds like you guys took as parents, but I imagine with twins you almost have to do in kind of asserting their independence.
Yeah.
With my kids now, like my kids are nearly 2 and 5, and they're boy and girl, so we're quite lucky, I suppose, in some respects that we don't have that. We have kind of natural barriers to them, the age barrier, the gender barrier, those kind of things make it easier for us to kind of, for them to kind of see differences in themselves naturally anyway. But I am still kind of equally aware of kind of making sure that things don't become competitive. And I think that's just it with parents. But I guess with twins, that's amplified.
We had to. We made some mistakes along the way, but this identity of Jack and Barney, it's almost singular identity of the two combined. We had to stop that. And then there was Jack separately, and then there was Barney. And they are very different. And so they do have a close bond. They don't have this kind of twin thing that they speak in a secret language to each other, but they obviously are very, very close.
Yeah.
But luckily the Malachi is the younger child, then they're similar. They're of a similar age, so he can find, he can still be part of this. Is a group of three, brothers, as opposed to this group of two and then one other. So that's an important thing for him. So we're very conscious of not to leave him out, and for him to be regarded by others and regarded by them as an equal part of the trio, if you like.
Yeah, it sounds very well thought through. And
it's only through experience, and has hidden many, many mistakes along the way and many minor disasters, but you kind of, you get through it.
You learn from them as well, don't you?
Yeah,
I mean, actually, you learn by doing. That's the best way, you know, that's the way we are as people and humans, right? It's that we do learn by doing. And if we, I guess it's being able to acknowledge your mistakes when they do come on.
Definitely. And in a way, in terms of, I find it, it's maybe more important, or at least as important, but it's harder to do that, I find, as a parent than to do it as a leader.
Yeah.
Because in some way, for me, the stakes are higher. I mean, in a leadership role, the stakes are important, but in a parenting role, then the stakes are even more important. You're helping shape a human. And because the stakes are higher, then I personally have found it probably more difficult to to instantaneously admit mistakes and learn from them. I eventually get there, probably through a process of osmosis from a parenting perspective. But yeah, I found that the parenting journey harder in that respect than the leadership journey.
Well, the one, I suppose the thing that as a recovering perfectionist, which we've talked about many times before.
I love that expression. I do give you credit whenever I use it. I say, my friend introduced me to the concept.
That's very kind. But the one thing that with parenthood is that you don't get another chance, do you? Like yeah. It's another life that you're creating. And, you know, as a parent, you are responsible for its outcome. The contrast, I suppose, between that and leadership at work and is that you can disband a business and you can kill a brand, or you can, you know, kill a product and start afresh and learn from that mistake and, you know, give it a new start. But you don't get that choice with children. Everything becomes formative and shapes who they are, you know. So
you do and you don't, because you're right in terms of the stakes are much higher because of that reason. But you do get another chance. You get another chance every new day.
Yeah.
And one of the things as being recovering perfectionists, then we tend to we set ourselves this kind of illusion of being constantly perfect, and we determine our self-worth by being perfect in the moment, and that's impossible to be perfect in every moment.
Yeah.
We're all slightly flawed individuals trying to do the best that we can. And that applies if we're a leader, as a parent. But if we screw up, as I do often, as a parent, you know what? In terms of tomorrow's another day, you move on. Thankfully, most of the mistakes I've made are not life threatening. Are going to kind of shape negatively their personalities dramatically. You just try and do the best you can, and being kind to myself, and being kind, and Sally and I being kind to each other, and individually and collectively to ourselves is an important thing, because it's a journey where you'll do lots of good things, you'll do lots of bad things, and if you beat yourself up about the bad things, it's going to make the journey of parenthood much more challenging and much less enjoyable and much less fulfilling. And so
yeah.
That's one of the lessons I've learned through experience is try and be kind and be tolerant to my own failings as a parent.
Yeah, and accept them, I suppose, for what they are. You know, you can't. There is no such thing as a perfect parent, despite what every media and everything around us tells you. There is no such thing, and if we don't learn from it, I mean that for me is kind of a measure of success. Really, is kind of, am I learning from it on a day to day, and do I kind of, if I keep making the same mistakes, then that's the failure to some extent.
Yeah.
It's not.
If there are constant patterns of things, then to learn from them and be aware. Even, I mean, I think the starting point is awareness. So if there are triggers, and probably for all of us, there are triggers in terms of what our kids can do, which can spark maybe a less than positive reaction in us, and being aware what those triggers are, and then deciding how you want to respond, because ultimately. How and as a coach, this is something I've really learned as a coach, is that how you choose to respond ultimately is a choice. So the trigger is a fact, but how I deal with that fact is very different. It could be raining outside, and I could decide that's another disastrous thing that's happening with lockdown and whatever, and that's, I get negative energy from that. Or I can look at the rain and think it's amazing to be inside when it's raining outside, or I get it's going to be great for the garden, or it makes me nostalgic for being a child in Ireland because it rained all the time being a child in Ireland, and I get a very different energy, and so it is a choice. And like the triggers and how I respond to those triggers as a parent is ultimately my choice.
And
being aware of that helps me mostly make better choices. I say mostly because I still make bad choices, and sometimes triggers are too much, so I go back to kind of the standard way of working, but it's, I think awareness and being conscious that it's a choice how you respond are helpful things.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you saying there about kind of being kind to yourself, and kind of we're always developing, right? As humans, that's kind of how it is that we don't just get to a certain age and say, right, dust the hands off now. I've finished now. I've turned 50. This is all great kind of thing. I can move on and be, you know, absolutely sure this is how it's going to go. We're forever developing, I suppose. And
100%.
And so being kind to yourself and accepting that things won't always go as you plan is a skill in itself to some extent. And how you, as you say, how you view the world. I like your analogy there on kind of, if it's raining outside, there are positives to every situation, aren't there?
Definitely. And you can choose which of the two that you adopt. The other thing about being kind, being kinder to yourself, is that you're modeling that behavior to your children. I think it was Brené Brown that said the best piece of advice as a parent you can give is to model the type of behavior you want in your children.
Yeah.
So if you want them to be kind, model being kind yourself. And
yeah.
if you want them to be open with their emotions, model that behavior in yourself as a parent, and they will see that, and they will learn from that, and they will grow from that. So by being kind to yourself and to your partner as a parent, then hopefully they will learn to be kind to themselves and also kind to others. One of the things that I've learned through life to kind of experience is you can't really be kind to other people unless fundamentally also you're kind to yourself. It does start with generosity and kindness to yourself, and there's so much more pressures children our age and children kind of your children's age than there were when we were growing up. And so it's a tough life. So the more they can learn those skills of kindness and acceptance, it's critical in terms of, so by modeling that ourselves, then they can hopefully learn from that.
Yeah. And also I think there's a sense of when you get those things wrong, right? The fact that, you know, there are times when I might get frustrated, and, you know, as I say, my kids are a lot younger, but there are times when I take my 5-year-old aside and say, I got that wrong.
Yeah.
I'm really sorry about that. I'll try and do better next time. And that they can see that you're trying. And I don't know how much of it they absorb, but certainly repetition and, you know, demonstrating it, as you say, modeling it in a way where, and that's something that I've always, you know, making mistakes is something that I kind of grew up not trying to do. And yet actually now what I realize is that those mistakes are actually as formative as anything else. So for them to kind of witness myself and my wife making mistakes and then kind of finding our way through those and proving to them that, okay, it wasn't the end of the world. There was another outcome. It didn't have to be catastrophic, you know. You're teaching them at every juncture, aren't you?
You only grow by doing new things, and by doing new things, you're going to fail.
Yeah.
And so it is, failure is an inevitable part of the growth journey.
Yeah.
And you can stay in your comfort zone, but nothing ever magical happens from your comfort zone. And to get to growth and to learning, you need to push yourself through that. And that feels very, it feels very uncomfortable. It feels very uncomfortable in a work environment. It feels very comfortable in a family environment. But it's the only way that you get growth. So I really love what you're doing there in terms of acknowledging to your children if you've made a mistake and repeatedly doing that, and that they see you being genuine in doing that, and they will learn from that, and that will become part of who they are as well.
Yeah. He's not as sympathetic when I make mistakes with Lego and things like that. They're not things that he's happy about. But, you know, again, he needs to learn that sometimes daddy won't get it right. That's okay kind of thing.
And some of my mistakes have gone into kind of family folklore in terms of they get brought out kind of on family gatherings. Do you remember when dad did X?
Yeah.
And so there's many of them. One that comes to mind was I'm a big Ireland sports fan, and Ireland had never beaten New Zealand, and I was watching on TV, they were playing New Zealand, this is about kind of 10 or 15 years ago, and we were ahead until the very, very last minute. In fact, the rugby game was on for 80 minutes, we were ahead until 87 minutes, and Sally was elsewhere, and the three that were young at this stage were beside me. And inevitably, New Zealand scored a try in the last minute to win the game. And I said a word I shouldn't have done. And I flung the remote control at the wall. And the remote control shattered. All three children instantaneously burst out crying. They hadn't heard me use that word before. And then Sally came into the room and just looked at the kids crying. The wall crumbled, the remote control shattered, and just gave me just a look. But that's one of the stories that comes up a lot of when Dad failed.
Do you remember when Dad did that? Yeah.
Exactly.
But look at the longevity it has, you know, it hasn't damaged them long term because you admitted your mistake, and now they're able to embrace it as humor and
the walls recovered, the remote controls recovered, my credibility is largely recovered.
still don't enjoy watching Ireland rugby games with you though.
No. Too much high stakes.
That's true.
To be fair, they have one of the things that I have managed to give my children, which I'm not sure is a good thing, is a love of Irish sport. And I am conscious that I'm probably subjecting them to a life of sporting failure and misery as a result, but they're following the dad in that.
History is no marker of the future, Morris. That's what they say, right?
I like that, Andy.
That's it. Their future, their experience may be very different. You never know.
Exactly.
Something you said about I'm interested to sort of understand kind of where you were at in your career when you had children and when that sort of journey started for you. In fact, when you decided to have children, I suppose, if you've been on an IVF journey as well, then there was a period before that, I presume, when you were working and trying and not succeeding. Where were you in your career at that point and how was that for you?
It started with the kind of meeting and connecting with Sally and realizing that this was something that I wanted to be part of our lives forever. And so that was in early to mid 30s probably. So that was full of joy, and exploration was great. I was leading my first business units at the time. So I think I was we had just moved back from the UK from the Netherlands to live in the UK, and I was a commercial director for the drinks company that I was involved in, and that was a new role that was busy. It was UK based, so at the time there wasn't much international travel, which was good, but it was very busy and there was quite a lot of pressure associated with it. So I was very conscious that I wanted to be a parent as much as Sally did, but I also had this other thing which was very consuming in my life in terms of to be successful in this role and to prove myself that I could do this role. Up to then I'd primarily been in marketing roles, and this was my first kind of commercial role, so I particularly wanted this one to be successful to prove I could.
Yeah. And how was that how did you find juggling that between the two of you kind of thing?
I found it very, very difficult in terms of, I had the best of intentions, and I was always there for every kind of, for everything important. But there's one thing kind of being physically there, and then it's kind of, are you really present though in that moment? And that's one thing which I've learned through time in terms of to be present in even the early days of parenthood. When you're reading a storybook, it's kind of commit to the storybook as opposed to thinking, okay, I need to do this quickly because I've got three emails to end and I've got a Zoom call. We don't have Zoom calls at the time, but I've got a call to do afterwards. And it's just living in the moment. And You try and do the best you can. I think companies weren't as mindful of this kind of balance debate, and people probably weren't as mindful of the balance debate, work life balance, as we are now. So it was kind of you were just kind of finding your feet, and I felt like I was juggling lots of balls in the air. And nothing quite managed to kind of fall on the ground and shatter, but there was times where it was very close. I do remember there being a lot of pressure trying to not let anybody down.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling that pressure quite a bit.
How did, if you don't mind me asking, how did Sally find it? Have you talked about that? Do you know how she found it kind of thing? Yeah.
She was doing also a very important kind of professional job, and it was very hard for her. And I think as a mother at a kind of deep physiological level, the experience is clearly different. You're both in it together.
Mm.
And so she was probably feeling in an even more deeper, profound way. But it was difficult, definitely.
Intense, yeah. Intense. And I think it's it's such a common thing, especially these days with the medical advancements in IVF and IUI and all the different things that you can have these days are incredible. And I think the amount of families that exist that wouldn't have existed 34 years ago is quite phenomenal. But I think what always strikes me is the sort of silent journey. And I suppose that's always part of why Born Human exists, is the fact that there is lots of these conversations are going on and lots of these situations are happening at home. And yet we're kind of turning up to work day in, day out, still trying to deliver at the same level as I was trying to deliver at before. And without the opportunity to necessarily share it with anyone at work. How sort of sensitive were your, you mentioned earlier that kind of work environments were different back then, but how aware was your seniors at that point of your situation, or was it completely behind closed doors?
They were very, very, I think the problem probably was more me than them. They were very sympathetic. And had I gone asking for help, then I'm sure they would have been very open and very supportive. But it wasn't the importance of dealing with people as humans at work and understanding that people are not just employees. Their fathers, their mothers, their sons, whatever, and dealing with them holistically, that didn't exist to the same extent then. So they were as sympathetic as I probably allowed them to be.
Mm.
But the culture, that was probably, that was early turn of the millennium. The culture was definitely different then. And I think, thankfully, it's becoming more progressive companies who understand. I think the nature of work is beginning to change, and the old command, control and compliance model and how you deal with people is changing. We all want different things now from work, and we all want to be the more that we feel that we're listened to, that we're seen, that we're valued, that we're trusted, we perform better, and so we're looking for different things from our companies than we used to do going forward. We're looking for different things from our leaders than we used to do going forward, and that's a change for the positive. So I think the issue was, if anything, I wasn't asking for enough help. And then a couple of years later, I got promoted to another role where I was setting up a global function. I was responsible for selling in airports and ferries around the world. And that was a new thing, and I was pulling together this global business. Hadn't been done before in the company. And that was a great professional opportunity. But it added to one extra dimension because I was traveling then globally.
Yeah.
And so I'd always try and make sure I was back at the weekend, but Monday to Friday, I was hardly ever there.
Wow.
So that placed a much greater pressure on Sally. Effectively, Sally, Monday to Friday, almost became like a lone parent.
Mm.
And then I was coming back at the weekend and trying to fully embrace being a father, but I felt bad not being around Monday to Fridays. As an Irish Catholic, I feel guilty for everything, but I certainly felt guilty, and for not being around as much as I would have liked. And also, it was like you arrive back on a Saturday morning from a plane from Miami or something, and you go straight into being a parent in terms of, and it's tiring.
Yeah,
and I've looked back at some of the early videos of birthday parties, and I was always there, always trying to be jolly. But now, when I look myself, I think, oh my God, I look so tired. I like to be ordinary. And it was hard physically. I mean, it was much easier what I was doing than what Sally was doing, but it was hard. And I don't think I was kind to myself, and I wasn't calling out the pressure that I felt about balancing everything. And so it was a wonderful period with amazing highs. I mean, I wouldn't have changed it for the world. But it had its tough moments as well.
Yeah. How long were you traveling for? Like, how long did that continue for? Was it most of your career in the end?
Yeah, since that was 2006, probably since 2006 until last year, until just before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so, as the kids grow older, the nature of the challenges and the, with them changes. But a lot of Monday to Fridays, I wasn't there. I had at various points in my career. I had kind of I was regional president for Africa at one stage, so I had to be in Africa all the time. One of the roles I had to be in Bermuda a certain amount of days a year, which sounded very glamorous, but my family and my life was back in the UK. So that was a challenge. So dealing with the travel was big. And to put this to context, most years I was probably only in the UK Monday to Friday, 75 days a year or something. So yeah, the majority was away. Mm. And you try and stay in contact, but it's never the same. And you call back at feeding time, or you call back when they're reading a book, or when the kids were going to bed, and you wanted to say hello to everybody, but it was very inconvenient because Sally was just about getting everybody to sleep, and then I'd come on from some exotic part of the world, trying to connect, and actually not being helpful probably in doing that. So I mean, it was my choice, and I could have chosen not to do that. But I was getting a lot of fulfillment from work, and it had its financial rewards, etc. But it did come at a compromise.
Mm. Do you think? I mean, I'm interested because it's like I think it's quite a common thing that people, you know, that the breadwinner generally is kind of, once you have kids, that one of you takes on the role, yeah, of the breadwinner, be that mum or dad. It doesn't. Thankfully, these days it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But there is a sort of there's a kind of tug of war goes on, right? Between I kind of want to provide for my family and give them everything they need financially and materialistically and all those kind of things. But then the emotional side of it means that the sacrifice potentially comes on the other side of it, right? And I suppose you could look at it the other way as well, that you know, some people go down the emotional route of kind of always being there in terms of being present and those kind of things. But as a result, they may lack other things, you know, and it might not be, you know, that will mean limited opportunities potentially and those kind of things as well. Did you generally feel like that sort of push and pull was always there kind of thing in terms of wanting to be more present kind of thing? But
yes, I think it was always, sometimes it was more explicit than others and more top of mind than others, but yeah, that tension was always there. And I couldn't find roles that were as stimulating or as enjoyable that were UK based only, and so it was the choice that I and we made. And I think I think people thankfully are becoming in kind of caveman days, a male role was kind of purely hunter-gatherer, and probably there was nothing about kind of connection with emotions, and now things are changing and changing for the better, and I think that there are cleverer ways, there are more nuanced ways that you don't have to make quite the same compromises. I think, yeah, one thing the kind of pandemic really has shown us is you can do work without doing travel. You can be clever about things. But the other thing is, I've probably realized through experience is that in work, what's critical isn't so much the inputs or even the outputs, it's the outcomes. And yeah, if you become ruthlessly focused on what are the two or three outcomes that are going to make a step change to your business and a step change to the business you're leading, the business unit or team, then actually you don't have to do as many, you know, the inputs don't have to be the same. I remember somebody very wise telling me kind of when I was in my 30s that he was giving me positive feedback, but he said that actually one of the things, Morris, about you is that you over prepare for everything. And I think that's driven by a common perfectionist nature, Andy. But understanding that and accepting that there's some things I'm okay to just be average at, but there's two or three things that I really need to be brilliant at as a leader, and manage my time better. And so that allows me time to invest more in the things that are very important to me, like family. So that's been a helpful discovery. And I wish I knew if I could go back to the 24-year-old Morris and say, listen, don't sweat the small stuff, focus on what's really important, manage your time more forcefully in terms of and prioritize behind those things that really matter. Say no to more things. I was bad at saying no. I was flattered to be asked to speak at this event or to do this thing or whatever. And actually, I could have said no more often. And had I done that, I would have got the balance better, not just the family work balance, but also the kind of time for Morris balance.
Yeah.
Because there needs to be some time over and above your family commitments and your work commitments that you're investing in yourself as a father, as a mother, as an individual. And that's typically the thing that I squeezed the most. And I think better prioritization and saying no more often, and therefore allowing me to say yes to what's important, would have been a lot helpful to know 30 years ago.
Yeah. How do you, I mean, obviously you've had a long career, and you've seen those, it's really interesting to kind of hear and to see how the workplace has changed, I suppose, over that period. And obviously having teams worked for you over that time as well. How have you found it kind of being on the managerial end of kind of managing teams that are having children and sort of their lives changing around you kind of thing? Obviously that's adapted, but how's that been for you?
I think I've always been naturally empathetic and naturally interested and concerned for people. So I think I was always, my intentions were always positive. Mm. But I think I can, having been through the journey myself, I understand the pressures more, and I understand in terms of some of the practical things that can be done. But I wish that kind of born human existed 15, 20 years ago when I was starting off my leadership journey, because it would have been something that would have been helped me as a leader and helped those people that I work with. Because what I'm always been interested in is growth, and especially in drinks, leadership development and personal development, and the common thing about all that is it involves people, and it involves allowing people the space and the opportunity to be themselves, and if they're truly themselves, they will be better. They'll be more fulfilled at work. They'll have higher retention at work. They'll be more engaged at work. They'll be more productive at work, and you will deliver better results. I probably always had that sense, but in my experience now and in my reading about leadership, and then I understand it more explicitly that leadership isn't about self. It's really about winning collectively by allowing other people to rise and to grow, and that involves them embracing their own humanity and giving them space and rejoicing in their own humanity, and to model that yourself. Because I think in my journey, I was probably more comfortable other people in my team being vulnerable and being open than I was myself. But I learned as a leader that if I didn't model the right type of behavior, then ultimately, although I might talk a good game, people wouldn't sustain that behavior because they would see me behaving in a different way.
Yeah. And
so I think as I've grown more experienced in terms of leadership, I'm more comfortable in being vulnerable myself and being open and saying, I have no clue what we should do here, but here's a plan, how are we going to find out? I'm not feeling the best about this, or I'm coming in at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning openly because my kids has got a dental appointment, or I'm leaving early on Wednesday afternoon because one of my kids are playing a rugby game. I'm much more comfortable being open about that and being very vocal about that, to partly to model and that to other people and to say it's perfectly acceptable to do that.
I guess that sort of brings us back to what we talked about earlier in terms of Brené Brown and modeling what you want for your kids, right? Not to suggest that your work colleagues are your kids, but if they are your part of your team, then actually why should we apply any different model to your work family than we do your own family, right?
Yeah.
The parallels there are quite stark in terms of how it's naturally evolved this conversation, but it is so true, isn't it, that if you don't sort of stand up and be what you expect of others, then you say one thing, do another. That never goes down, does it?
No, so it's interesting though, because I have, and this relates to something we said earlier, but I found it easier initially to be vulnerable as a leader than I found it easier to be vulnerable as a parent. And I do think it is that point again about the stakes seemed higher. But you're absolutely right. It's the same principles.
Mm. Well, yeah, but I think it's, I suppose, you know, when you look back sort of 20 years or whatever to when workplace models were very different, actually, I think we have to be kind to ourselves to say, well, actually, nobody was thinking that way. That wasn't how we expected the workplace to work. So why would we? It's taken kind of cognizance of humanity to kind of say, actually, if we recognize that in people, then there is value in it, that it does bring different behaviors. And it also takes the courage of leaders to be able to be kind of pioneers in that and to turn around and say, do you know what, I believe in it, so that's what we're going to do. And it will, it, you know, nothing changes without somebody taking the first step. And we can just continue to model. I was talking to colleague of mine earlier on about kind of organization that they work with, and they're very supportive of the work they do in the community and kind of changing communities that they work within, but their inward organization is very 1970s, so it only functions in old ways. And yet, so it's kind of, it feels like a really juxtaposed situation to kind of be looking outside and saying, it's really great that you're changing all these organizations, but what about our organization? But nobody, I suppose then that comes back to our humanity, right? In as far as it's always more difficult to look at yourself than it is to give advice to other people and say, yeah, you guys should be doing that. That seems like a really sensible solution. I guess that brings me on really neatly to generous spirits and kind of where that came from for you. And I mean, that's, we've obviously met over the last few months and had lots of conversations. And it's been a really amazing connection for me, but I think I'd love you to sort of share how you came to that and where it all came from and where you are with it now and what you're looking to do with it. That would be great.
Absolutely. So I left my last corporate role in about April of last year, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and the pandemic was in the early stages. And to begin with, I did the usual thing of binge watching Netflix for about kind of 3 or 4 weeks, and that was very good. But I thought there is a limit how I can do this for.
I'm not sure there is a limit, Maurice. Yeah. I've got to be honest. I've yet to know anyone who's completed Netflix, but yeah, no,
that's true. But I knew it was something I couldn't do as my only thing for the rest of my life. And I've always been really interested in transformation of businesses and brands, and especially with my experience in the alcohol beverage world, and the transformation of teams and the transformation of individuals. And so one of the things I've had on my bucket list for a long time was coaching. And I've always been a mentor at work, and especially mentoring people that had kind of were cognitively diverse, maybe came from different backgrounds, and I gained a lot from that as well. But mentoring is different to coaching. So I put myself through a kind of 10-month coaching program, and I've been supporting entrepreneurs and business leaders facing some of the challenges I had, but also some of the challenges, and really really enjoyed that and worked with some incredible people. And to witness people's growth and to witness them changing and becoming who they really want to be is kind of very, is profoundly kind of moving. And as a coach, you don't do that, they do that, but you provide the space, a safe and brave space for them to be able to do that. And that's, I find that really rewarding. But I've also been able to combine that with business support and advisory support for startups in the alcohol space. And non-alcohol, in the beverage space. And then it's about working with like-minded people who are doing some interesting things and just helping them build their brand and scale their business. And at the same time, I've been kind of reading up on leadership and speaking to leading academics and authors and leadership. So I thought I had to have something which united all these things. And so I came up with the business and the name Generous Spirits. And generosity is one of the values that I've always had. Pun on spirits, but also from a coaching perspective, there's a generosity of spirit that I think is helpful to be a good coach, because it isn't about you when you're coaching, it's always about the person that you're trying to support.
Yeah.
And so I've been doing that now for the last year, and it's been evolving with another amazing coach. We've co-founded this program called Manual Reset, which is about men and men coming to terms with their feelings. As we know, that men are often very uncomfortable about expressing their feelings to themselves and to other people, and try and create a safe and brave space for people to do that. And so this is a 10-week program that we do, and we get like-minded men and to see their growth and the support of each other. Some of the feedback that we've got has been really inspiring, and I'm enjoying that. And these men that we work with in this course range from probably early 20s to late 50s, but often it's around parenting and early parenting or late parenting, and balancing that with work. And is work allowing them the space to be, well, is what they're doing with work allowing them the space to be the father, the son, the friends, the brother that they want to be? And these are quite profound questions that you can help people find answers to. And the role of a coach is to help deepen the learning and forward the action. And so it's been really good. And I've got no roadmap kind of going forward about kind of where Generous Spirits is going to go, but I'm really enjoying the journey. And probably, Andy, I've learned more and I've failed more and done more new things in the past year than I've done in the past decade. And that's been scary. That's been exhilarating. It's been fun, but it's been really fulfilling.
Yeah. And that's a wonderful thing, right? That your journeys, you know, for the conversation we've had leading up to this about your journey both at work and as a dad has kind of brought you to a place where you've got a more rounded, holistic view that you can kind of pick up on the bits that you really appreciate and the bits that you really love. And also as a leader, working out the bits that really add value and how they add value, having seen both sides of it, really having seen it function in the old world and the new world, and knowing emotionally what the differences it can bring and kind of how people can respond to that and react to it.
Definitely. And by going through this coaching journey, it fundamentally has helped me as a leader, because actually one of the most important requirements of a leader is to be a great coach, is to recruit and develop the people that they can fulfill their potential. And that's about it. And so I don't know in the future whether I'll go back into a leadership role, and if I've got space to create a difference, then I might do. But the coaching will always be a part of what I do. Either as a coach or as a leader, it helps me. And in some ways, even as a parent, it helps me. It helps me in my own awareness of my own kind of weaknesses and where I make mistakes and the patterns of behavior I make mistakes. So that helps me as a parent. But what doesn't help me is as a parent is my sons have a radar for when I'm using any kind of coaching tips on them. So if I start using any coaching questions on them, Andy, they give me feedback very quickly that, okay, that's all very well for the people you work with. I'm not going to work over the breakfast table. So don't try it, Dad. So if I say, well, what are you afraid of? Are there different perspectives you could look at this? And they go, Dad, I don't want to hear that coaching stuff.
Yeah.
There's a time and a place for it, but now is not the time. Now is not the, this isn't the place.
How do you find, obviously, now with COVID and everything, like, and obviously a change, that kind of profound change that you've been through, how has that been for you in terms of the relationship with your boys and kind of being home more, presumably, and kind of...
It's been mostly hugely positive. I say mostly because it took us a while to recalibrate the fact that Monday to Friday, Sally wasn't a lone parent.
Yeah.
And so it took time for the boys to understand that I was there, and probably took a time for me to appreciate that Sally had a routine that had worked for 16 years. So there's no point in me coming back and trying to completely change it. I do remember, Andy, one moment where one of our boys was looking for Sally, and I was asking kind of why he was looking for his mum, and he said, well, I want to check whether I can do something. And I said, you know, I'm a parent too. And he said, oh yeah, but that's true, Dad, but I'm not used to you being around Monday to Friday. And yeah. it was a weird mix of emotions, because at one level it was like a dagger in my heart,
yeah,
that I'm being there. But also it was positive that I was around to being, I was now around to be able to be involved more. And with lockdown, everybody was living, as we know, in kind of in a much more together enclosed state. And so being around for that was really good. And even now things are opening up, I can be around more often. So if there's a drop off to school, I can do that. I can collect them more.
Yeah.
I can always be there for the midweek rugby sessions, training sessions, etc., in a way that I wasn't before. So it's definitely much more positive, and I am prioritizing that more than anything else, because although they will always be our children, I'm conscious that in a few years they'll be working or be in uni or won't be at home, and the relationship will still be obviously hopefully there, but it'll be not as day to day, and my role as a parent will change. And so I'm trying to make sure that I make the most of this time.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, again, that comes down to self-awareness and all those kind of things, doesn't it? And the whole rain situation of like, well, you know, on one level, this is not a great time, but on another level, it's forcing us all to embrace the things that, you know, travel and work would have otherwise prevented. Brings families closer together, hopefully, at least in some capacities, not always that straightforward. But
Other thing I found is by not traveling, I was significantly less tired. So I remember 2 weeks after I stopped traveling, then I woke up one morning with a strange feeling, and I was not being tired.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, oh my God, I can't remember this feeling of not being tired.
Yeah.
Sleep is such an important thing in our well-being. If you're sleep deprived, then your energy changes, your mood changes, your resilience changes. It's been a big help dealing with everything the last years have shown me, the fact that I probably had the best sleep I've had over a consistent period, because normally what I'd be trying to do is catch 3 or 4 hours sleep on a plane coming back from New York, and then having a quick shower, heading straight into work, and then with a drink straight off, there's dinners, or you go around on trade, and there's late nights and whatever. So it's kind of not the most healthy. It's a very enjoyable, but not the most healthy of lifestyle. And so it's been good to be able to be a bit healthier and sleeping more and investing more in me.
Yeah. That's really good to hear. And I think as I say, taking the positives out of what the last year has been for everyone, there have to be positives in it. And I think if we can all focus on them, then that's not a bad thing.
One of the things I think about last year, and for me, is having had a work change as well. It was almost like a gap year, and yeah. I think most people had that gap year when they were 18 or 19, and I'm coming to a gap year much later in life. But the idea of taking breaks or taking sabbaticals, I think is such a really helpful thing, because if and it's something I'll encourage my children to do, because they'll have 50 years probably of work to live, 70 or 75 probably. And so they're not going to have one career anymore with one employer. They're going to have five or six careers with 20 employers and the whole gig economy. And we're allowing them opportunity to recharge the batteries and refresh and recalibrate what they want to do is a really important thing, because it's allowing them to take control of their own journey as opposed to just continuing on the journey they're in. And I was reading about the science of sabbaticals and the history of sabbaticals, and there's a lot of kind of scientific evidence to prove it, and I hadn't realized, but it makes sense. It goes back obviously to the Sabbath, taking a rest on a Sunday, and also from a farming perspective, every 7 years leaving a field fallow, able to no plants, no objectives, just to be and grow, just to be a field, and to get all the nutrients back and get all the energy back to be able to spend the next 7 years growing things like crazy again. Yeah. And I think there's something really powerful in that. So I'm having a great gap here.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I was literally about to ask a question, what one piece of advice would you give to your children now? And I think you just answered it right there, to be a field for a year, a field, and take the time to kind of find yourself, I suppose, by the sound of things.
Be a field. That would be huge. I think be kind to themselves.
Yeah.
Would be massive. And also one of the things as a parent you wish with your siblings is that they be there for each other. One of the things that my parents growing up in Ireland were very insistent upon, that they wanted, I came from, there's four of us, four siblings, that they wanted us to stay connected. And their legacy was that the four of us would stay connected. And we didn't have to live in each other's kind of world all the time. But when we got together, there was a family tie, and we'd always be there for each other.
Yeah.
And I'm fortunate enough for my siblings, we have that. And I really desperately want that for my children as well, that after we're gone, that they'll be there for each other and probably get together and still always joke about a time that Dad threw the remote control at the wall when Ireland lost the rugby.
Dad was stronger than we gave him credit for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
On the remote control and won.
That's it, yeah. Well, it's been really lovely to have you on. Thank you so much for coming on, Maurice, and telling us about your fascinating journey. I will share details of Generous Spirits with the world in the show notes, so we'll do that. And if anyone wants to reach out to you, then they can, presumably through the website.
Absolutely.
But I will leave it there and say thank you very much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to have you. And, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Andy. I really enjoyed it myself. Thank you.
Pleasure. Take care. And there we have it. That's another week done for the Born Human podcast. A huge thank you to Maurice for joining us this week. Maurice is someone that I've really come to know and respect and appreciate being able to talk to and learn from. Having come from a corporate background myself, it's really refreshing to find other people that have similar outlooks on our humanity and the importance of that, both in the workplace and at home, and finding the right balance. And I think he made a couple of really wonderful points there, one of which that really stuck out for me around not sweating the small stuff and trying to keep things in perspective, I suppose, realising that, you know, it's about us finding the right balance for us and making sure that we're able to give ourselves the time for the things that are important to us. So I hope this has been a useful conversation for you guys as much as it has for me. And I'm sure there'll be plenty of you out there that can relate to that push and pull that we discussed, and the fact that being present at work and at home isn't always easy. As ever with all of these, they're not designed to be a mantra to live by. What they are is about lived experience and somebody else sharing their experience and knowing that what we go through is different for each of us, but we do have common ground. So in that, I will love and leave you for another week. So please do share and subscribe, do all those good things wherever you get your podcasts. We're very grateful for your support and we love having you along. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next time.